Okay, Mr. Benson, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honor, before I start, I have two things I wanted to address with the court. One is that I have a cell phone here. It's an old BlackBerry. It doesn't have any power or anything. I'm just going to use this in my argument. It's not the missing cell phone. We haven't found the missing cell phone, so I just want to let the court know if that's okay with the court.
Counsel, any objection?
All right.
Secondly, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent John Turner. If you've had a chance in the past few days to watch the news on TV or look at it on the internet, you may have come across a story about a tourist in Las Vegas who was stranded in McCarran Airport overnight. What happened was he had a late night flight home and the airlines canceled it. Rather than taking a cab to a hotel, he decided to spend the night in the airport. While in the airport, he made a video. And the video shows different scenes of our Terminal D with no passengers, only him. And in the video, he's singing the song, All By Myself. He did this all with his cell phone. Not the cell phone, but a cell phone. This story illustrates that a cell phone is no longer a device where you receive calls or make calls. It's much more than that. With a cell phone, we make videos. We take pictures of our loved ones and friends. We send emails and texts that may contain some very confidential information or private information or business information. The cell phone keeps track of what we do. It has a list of our contacts, personal and business. And it also allows us to search the web. And it keeps a log of that too. We should be able to be the ones to decide when and if we want to share any information on our cell phone with someone else. The Fourth Amendment, the right of privacy, should protect us from the search of our cell phone by the government. In order to search a cell phone, police need to have a warrant that shows probable cause and that has been reviewed by a judge and magistrate. In this case, the police did not have reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop John, nor to search the cell phone they took out of his pocket. This case is not just about John. This case has strong policy concerns that affect every person in Nevada and the information on their cell phone. Now, the Supreme Court knows that there are two cases pending in the United States Supreme Court right now that were argued a few months ago, and we will, in the next few days or 2 weeks, receive an opinion on the constitutionality of the search of a cell phone. One of those cases, United States versus Rowdy, is a First Circuit case. In that case, the police arrested a man, and after they arrested him, they were back at the police station, they started flipping through the cell phone. They uncovered information which then led to subsequent crimes. There are two cases pending, both reaching opposite results. The Riley versus California case did not require a warrant to go into a cell phone. But what's interesting about these two cases, in both instances, when the search occurred, the person was already arrested. That's not the case here. Here there's two searches. One occurred when John was detained. The second occurred after he was identified through this one-on-one type of identification, which then we could arguably say, well, maybe then he's arrested. Both of them occurred out in the field. None of the searches occurred in the police station. So let me go through the steps as to what happened here. Initially, he was stopped. He was on the side of the road arguing with somebody else. And he was stopped by Officer Sutri, who testified, I stopped him because he matched the description of a suspect in a robbery that I received over the 911 call, over the CAD report. Here's the description. Two black males, both 18 years old. One was 140 pounds, 5'1", black hair, wearing a gray sweater, a sweatshirt with a hoodie. The second 18-year-old wore a black hoodie. So what did John look like? John was a black male, 36 years old, 5'6". He was either 250 or 195 pounds, had black hair. He had facial hair on his face. And even the alleged victim, Jose Rodriguez, did not recall the person who took his cell phone as having facial hair. So this is what Citre based his reasonable suspicion, his articulable evidence for stopping John. It's simply not there. Even the state admits that John did not match the age, the height, the weight. This certainly is insufficient to stop him. And perhaps the officers even questioned their stop because they stopped three other people after they stopped John and tried to do some more one-on-one identifications, but by this time, the alleged victim said that, you know, I already identified. We filed a motion to suppress the stop and everything stemming from it at trial, and the court did not agree. And so I think the court erred in this because he clearly did not match the description. But the state came up with another reason. They said, well, not only did he match the description, which he didn't, he also was getting almost getting into a fight with someone else. We had no information as the other person. There was nothing written in the police report about who it was or what happened. And even Officer Citre said he stopped him because of the identification. When he stopped him, he then asked for permission to search his pocket. At this time, John was still arguing with the other man. He said, okay. Tell him to why he was placed in handcuffs and being taken over to the police car, not even told. When they got to the police car, and after Officer Citre had taken the cell phone out of his pocket, Officer Citre pressed a button on the cell phone. And the button on the cell phone allowed him to look at the home page. Officer Citre testified the home page was in Spanish. He said he didn't go any further into the cell phone. However, the fact that he looked at the home page by pushing a button was a search because it was something else he had to do. He had to get into the cell phone. He wasn't the only one who went into the cell phone. Officer Wagner did the same thing. Officer Wagner brought the alleged victim over to do a one-on-one. And the victim identified John. And then Officer Wagner picked up the cell phone, hit the button, and looked at the home page and said it was in Spanish. Now, I suggest to the court that when the police detain a suspect, they do not have the authority to go into anyone's cell phone, whether it be the home.
What if the defendant gives consent to the search of his pocket for the cell phone? And didn't that happen in this case?
He did give consent to the search of his pocket. He did not know why he was placed in handcuffs. He was in handcuffs at the time. But a search, consent to search is limited to what the request is. The request was, can I search your pocket, go into your pocket? And he did. And he never asked him, do I have permission to search the cell phone? Never asked him that. John was prejudiced by this because at trial, they have a flimsy identification. We have John, he does not match the description. It's a cross-racial identification, which is more susceptible to error than any other crime. We have a missing cell phone. Don't know what happened to the cell phone. Police never took any identification of it other than it was a Cricket smartphone. It was black, sometimes gray. Other times the phone itself was black and gray. They just do not have a case against John being the alleged robber. Even during jury instructions, at one point, when we were asking for an instruction saying that if you don't believe they've proven the identity of the robber as being John, you should acquit. The court didn't give that jury instruction. But she did say that, well, if it wasn't the alleged victim's, it was probably somebody else's.
So what did the police do with the cell phone that they took out of his pocket?
The police gave it back to the alleged victim. And we objected to this procedure. It's not a procedure that is supposedly allowed by Metro. They're supposed to document them. I mean, everybody has a cell phone there. I don't know why they couldn't take a picture of it with their own cell phone. I'm not sure if they have that capability, but they should. So they took no pictures. They did not even document the phone number.
Is there really a Fourth Amendment question here about searching the cell phone when the officer opens the cell phone, it's in Spanish, can't read it, can't identify it, and then the other officer opens the cell phone, can't read it, can't identify it, they just return the cell phone back to the defendant? I mean, I don't quite understand what the search question is here. They didn't glean anything from it. They opened it, but nothing happened with that evidence, correct?
Well, no, they used that evidence at trial to argue this was proof that the cell phone did not belong to him, that belonged to the alleged victim. So that's why it became very important.
How did they identify the cell phone with the victim if they couldn't tell what it said?
Well, they said it was in Spanish, and they had asked John if he spoke Spanish, and he said no. So they introduced his statement that he didn't speak Spanish. They introduced both officers saying they went into the cell phone, and the homepage was in Spanish. And then the alleged victim was Hispanic and spoke Spanish. Well, he did testify.
Didn't she testify that was her cell phone?
Testify it was, and testify that the cell phone that he had was not in Spanish. So he testified his cell phone was not in Spanish. The officers testified this was in Spanish. If you don't have any other questions, I'll reserve the remaining time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices. My name is Tyler Smith. May it please the Court. I'm a Deputy District Attorney with the Clark County District Attorney's Office here for the State of Nevada. One aspect that I completely disagree with counsel on is the description being completely inaccurate. If you listen to the phone call, the 911 call when Mr. Rodriguez was desperately trying to tell the operator what happened to him, you can tell there's a real language barrier going on. Mr. Rodriguez is from Mexico. He can do some basic communications in English, but his native language is Spanish. And even throughout the trial, throughout hearings, throughout speaking with him, an interpreter was used. So he's able to get across some basic details, but anything really in depth he kind of had difficulty with. And you can even hear the 911 operator getting really frustrated with Mr. Rodriguez, saying, well, how tall is he? How tall is he? And he's doing his best to spit it out, and eventually she goes, well, what is he? Is he 5'6"? Is he 5'1"? She goes, oh, he's 5'1". And so everything that is which is not completely accurate that Mr. Rodriguez is talking about has to do with estimations of numbers, height, weight, things of that nature. But what is accurate is things that are universal. I mean, he says, well, he was an African-American male. He was wearing a gray sweatshirt. He had a black thing on his head. This happened a few minutes ago. I saw him walk south on Las Vegas Boulevard, and all of that matched. When Officer Citri gets this call over the radio, that's the information that he has. And so he also has this knowledge that this occurred nearly minutes before. And he even testified, I knew the person I was looking for had to be in that immediate area. And so he goes a few blocks south of Charleston on Las Vegas Boulevard, and he sees an African-American male wearing a gray sweatshirt. He recalled the dispatcher telling him that it was blue or black pants. That's not in the cab report, but that's what the officer recalled. And so he sees, minutes later, south on Las Vegas Boulevard, just a couple blocks from where this occurred, and he also sees him arguing with another individual across the street. He had a rock in his hand. And so he makes a stop. Now, to expect the officers as they're driving by, oh, wait, wait a second, he's not exactly 5'6 or 5'1, he's a little bit heavier, and not investigate is just not reasonable. And so Officer Sistry decided to investigate. And as he's taking, going to the defendant, the defendant's not even paying attention to him. He's still focused on the gentleman across the street. And that's how heated this argument was. And in fact, Officer Sistry testified that the gentleman across the street actually flagged him down to try and get him some help. And so the reasonable suspicion to investigate was clearly there. He has the same race, same directions, same relative location, and just minutes after that this was reported. And so I disagree with the notion that this description didn't match the defendant in this case.
Can you tell me whose cell phone it was?
Yes, it was the victim's cell phone. After when the officer asked to search the pocket, he sees the cell phone in the pocket, asks if he can grab the cell phone. The defendant tells him yes. They look at the cell phone, it is in Spanish, and now Mr. Rodriguez did testify, he thought it was in English, this was months later. However, when Mr. Rodriguez gets to the scene to do the one-on-one, the officers take steps to ensure that it's his cell phone. Before they even show it to him, they ask him, well, what kind of phone is it, what does it look like? And he tells them what it looks like. They then show him the phone, he says, yes, that's my phone. And Officer Sistry, I believe that was actually Officer Wagner, had him go through the phone to look through it to make sure it was his. Are these his contacts? Are these?
Why don't they ask him, what's your phone number, and use their cell to dial the phone to see who was going to ring?
That certainly could have been done, but I think that supposes that Mr. Rodriguez was somehow mistaken that this is his phone, or that he was, you know, being untruthful to the officers that this is his phone. I mean, if you look through your cell phone, those are your contacts, those are your text messages, those are your emails. It's reasonable for the officer to believe him once he's looked through all that stuff. Because if those aren't his, I mean, honestly, what am I going to really do with somebody else's phone if I don't know about you, Justice, but I can't remember any phone numbers saved my life these days. All of the phone numbers that I have are saved in my cell phone. So it's not unreasonable for the officer to accept Mr. Rodriguez's statement that this is my phone, because why would he say it was his phone if it indeed wasn't? Now, yes, an extra step could have been taken. What's your phone number? Dial the phone. Is that it? But I don't believe that renders their actions unreasonable.
Why would he say that his phone was in English? I mean, come on. That doesn't make sense to me.
I agree, Justice. This isn't part of the record. When I talked to him, he said, oh, yeah, it was in Spanish. And then all of a sudden, as it so often happens when they get on the stand, sometimes they forget or that changes. I don't think this trial happened months or almost a year later. He has a new phone at this point. He just testified that phone is now in English. And so maybe he got that mixed up with his old phone and his new phone.
That's what makes trials so exciting.
Oh, it is. Your heart kind of drops when they say something that they didn't say earlier. I agree. And so if there's no other questions on the stop, I'd like to move on whether or not was a search of the cell phone. Before we even get to that point, before a search can even happen, quite honestly, Justice, I don't think this is the appropriate case to even answer that question, because in order to challenge a search of something, you have to have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that object. All the evidence we have in this case, there was no contradictory evidence that this was the victim's cell phone. He identified it, he says, that's my phone.
Counsel, isn't that kind of after the fact? You're putting one fact, you're reversing the rule to get to the conclusion you're making? At the point of this alleged search, did we know?
At the point of the first search...
It's like if I take the wallet out of your back pocket, do I have a right to go into that wallet?
Would you have an
expectation of privacy?
If the wallet is not my wallet, if it's a stolen wallet, I would know.
You gave me permission to go in your pocket, I took this wallet out. Am I free to just go into it?
If it's not my wallet, I would say yes. If it is a stolen wallet that matches the description of a stolen wallet, in which
but does the officer need to know?
I don't believe the officer does need to know. No.
Or does he get just a free shot, and then afterwards he can make the decision that, well, it wasn't your wallet, so you had no expectation?
Well, I guess that's one way of putting it, Justice Douglas, but the fact of the matter
at
is...
At the moment of the stop, Officer Citri know that the suspect had stolen the cell phone of the victim?
At the exact moment, I'm kind of confused.
At the time Citri stopped the defendant in this case, did he know that one of the things that occurred was the theft of the cell phone from the victim?
Yes, he knew that either a black or gray Cricket cell phone had been taken. That was information was given through the 911.
But he asked, can I look in your pocket and look at the cell phone?
Exactly, Justice. He saw that there was a cell phone, a black or gray cell phone, inside the defendant's pocket. That's when he asked permission if he could take the specific phone. It wasn't even a request to search his pockets. It was a request to actually retrieve the cell phone that he saw in his pocket. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, he was aware that a cell phone, that this was a strong-arm robbery and a cell phone had been taken. And I also believe, if I recall correctly, he was aware that it was a Cricket smartphone, and which the phone, after he takes it out of the defendant's pocket, is indeed a Cricket smartphone. So, it's a stolen phone, and the officer knows that these are the facts of this case. I would argue that the defendant, with a stolen cell phone, has no expectation of privacy in that phone. That's not his information in the phone. That is not his contacts. Those aren't the emails. That's not anything that he has ever entered into that phone. He does have an expectation of privacy in his own pocket, but he gave permission for that pocket to be entered. And furthermore, and kind of following up on what you asked counsel, the home screen, I would argue the home screen of the phone, simply pressing that button is not a search. Simply due to the fact that action really doesn't reveal any information of criminality. Now, as indicated in this case, the phone was in Spanish, the defendant said he didn't speak Spanish. However, the concern is going through your emails, your text messages.
What came up on the home page of a Cricket smartphone? When I open my iPhone, you gotta punch in the code. I get nothing. I mean, without punching in the code, there's nothing to look at.
That's correct. And really, basically, if the phone is protected by a code, the only thing you can really get out of punching the button on the home screen is the time, the date, and the battery power. It's essentially all you can get out of that.
See, I keep trying to get Justice Charity's code so I can find out all of the secrets that are in that phone. But in this case, you mean that the phone in this case, if you push the button, you actually see something more than some of the identifiers you just mentioned?
I don't believe so.
Evidence about what it showed?
It never really came out in evidence of what exactly came up on the phone, but I have never seen any kind of smartphone that comes up with any other information other than date, time, battery power, maybe the...
Counsel's description of a home page. I guess different people have different home pages, what comes up. But was there any testimony about what the officer observed other than it's in Spanish, whatever it was?
There was not. I can speculate to be what exactly was in Spanish. My guess would be the date. Oftentimes the date would be in Spanish or information such as that. I know on an iPhone that says, swipe to unlock, that could be put into a different language.
Maybe the apps came up? Is that what came up, the apps?
I don't believe the apps came up. You actually have to open the phone to be able to get to an app on a smartphone.
Not mine.
Sorry,
if you open mine, I don't have a code, so...
You don't have a code, that's true, but it would take more actions other than just pressing the button. It would require other things to open the phone.
But I think my apps are in English.
Mine are too.
Your phone is far more transparent than most people's phone, Justice Cherry.
And with that, do you just have any further
questions? I wanted you to comment on the post Miranda's right to remain silent, the violation of that by the police officers when they testified.
There were two different instances that the appellant brought up of comments on supposed silence. The first time was when Officer Citri actually had arrested or taken the defendant into custody. At that time, the testimony came out. He just wasn't cooperating, but not that he wasn't cooperating, he wasn't even paying attention to me. So it's not that he had been giving Miranda warnings and the defendant invoked those Miranda warnings and decided that he did not want to cooperate with police, did not want to speak to him. He wasn't even paying attention to Officer Citri at that point. What he was doing is he was still shouting at this other individual across the street who had flagged the officer down. So there was no real comment on an attempt to invoke his Fifth Amendment right, because in reality he didn't remain silent. He wasn't even being asked questions at that point. He was simply shouting at this other man. In the second instance, what the appellant brought up was when Officer Wagner asked the defendant while he was in the car if he spoke Spanish. After he gave his answer, then Officer Wagner says, and at that point, he just didn't want to answer any more questions. At that point, he did not elect to remain silent. He elected to answer the officer's question. And the jury is going to know that questioning eventually stops. Questioning eventually is going to no longer go forward after either the defendant or the officer decides not to ask any more questions. So there can't be really a comment on an invocation of a Fifth Amendment right if you don't remain silent, if you agree to speak, and that's what happened there.
If it's error, you think it's harmless? It's a little softball, by the way.
Yes, I would argue that it's a harmless. If it's an error, it would be a harmless error. We have overwhelming evidence, contrary to what is being argued by the appellant in this case. We have the location, the timing, the victim. Now, the victim's identification here, which was also brought up, is actually contrary to what they say is not an unreliable identification. This was in the middle of the day. Mr. Rodriguez he ran up to Mr. Rodriguez and punched him in the face and left. There was a conversation that actually happened between the victim and the defendant. First, as Mr. Rodriguez was crossing the street, the defendant asked him if he could use his cell phone. There's a conversation about the cell phone. Mr. Rodriguez tells him, no, it's actually not working. And now, Mr. Rodriguez was not telling the truth at that point. He just didn't want to give the defendant the cell phone, and he used that as an excuse. After that, the defendant asked him for a dollar, and Mr. Rodriguez says, no, I don't have any money. And then there's a conversation about, Mr. Rodriguez's heritage and if he's from Mexico or Mexican, it's such as that. So there was a substantial conversation and interaction between Mr. Rodriguez and the defendant. And then he makes an identification minutes after this happens. So this wasn't some middle of the night, come up behind him and hit him in the back of the head and take his phone. There was a lot of interaction leading up to that. If there are no further questions, I believe my time's expired. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Ms. Dickinson, do you want to comment on the post-Miranda silence? Post-Miranda right to remain silent?
Yes, that was issue 6. Both officers testified that they gave him Miranda and that he didn't answer questions. I think that's error because they were pointing out to the jury that he was being uncooperative. They acted like he was trying to hide something. There were only 3 witnesses in this trial. And so 2 of them were talking about Miranda. There was no reason for the prosecutor to bring that issue forth. That coupled with the fact the officers both testified about scope, suggesting that his identification in scope of 250 pounds was incorrect because he was only 195 pounds. So now we have 2 more errors where, first they're Miranda, then we have them talking about scope, and we objected, and the court said, she instructed the jury or said it was something like a driver's license, which we all know it's not. So there certainly is cumulative error here, if not only the error with regard to the Fourth Amendment. I disagree with some of the facts the prosecutor brought forth. Officer Citre testified on page 355 that when he hit the Cricket smartphone, the home screen came up. On page 340, he said, I pressed the button. He could tell it was in Spanish. It had Spanish terms. Nothing he could read on the home page. And he also testified that he asked to search his pockets. He did not say the cell phone. So I disagree with what the prosecutor said about that. I know on my cell phone, even though I do have a lot, things do come up, like text messages and other things that are in English. With regard to how long it was before he made the identity, it was 20 minutes. We know this because Jose testified he had to walk to another building to try to get somebody to make a phone call for him because he didn't have a phone anymore. And he testified it was about 20 minutes before he did an ID. With regard to ID, Wagner admitted when he took him to the ID location for a one-on-one, he told him, we want your ID, the guy who matches the description. I think that was error. He certainly tainted the description. Jose said at trial that the reason he identified John was based on two things, or maybe three. The clothing that he was wearing, something on his head. He was a black man. He didn't say black man, but we know that was the one common thing they had. What the prosecutor doesn't say is that supposedly it was kids who took this, 18-year-olds. So, and John does not match that description at all. What will somebody do with a cell phone, a smartphone that's not theirs? That question was asked. Sell it. These things are stolen all the time and sold. With regard to reasonable expectation of privacy, he has an expectation of privacy with anything that's in his pants pocket. And if you don't believe that, then the police can always go and go through everything in your pants pockets when they stop you for an investigatory stop. That's what it was at this point. I want to point out that the identification was not enough for probable cause under U.S. v. Brown, where they said that just identifying a person's race and identifying that they were in a black car is insufficient to stop any black male in a black car. It's just not enough. If I could just say one more thing.
Yes, go ahead.
When I was looking at the case again last night, I noticed that the state cited a 2002 Osborne case, and they were arguing standing and lack of privacy. That has to do with a GPS device placed on a car. It's my understanding that would be overruled by the United States Supreme Court case, the Jones case. So I would ask the court not use that case in reaching a decision.
Okay, Ms. Dickinson, Mr. Smith, thank you for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess until then.